Gifted Talks Fundraising offers you a seat at the table for a relaxed chat about what it takes to build successful giving programs. Marshalling decades of practical hands-on experience, the Gifted Directors provide helpful advice and top tips for achieving your fundraising goals. Here we are, Gifted Talks Fundraising is back, and we're back here at 1 Mill Street. Amy, good to see you again. Thanks for braving the journey all the way from Leeds. And,
nice to be here, as always.
Yeah, and we're meeting in the centre of the universe. Even Chris has been dragged up from London again. Thank you, mate. Got you
always
off.
Always a pleasure to come to Royal Leamington Spa,
Andy. Yeah, you're a good man. Thanks for the promotion of this brilliant town. Look, today we're going to talk, it's actually the engine room of any major fundraising, and that's the plan. If you're capital fundraising, that is raising money for all sorts of projects, but using the methodology of capital fundraising, you have a campaign plan. But equally, this can be a conversation, I think, around the development plan that your development team are working to year on year, and what's in it and what to look out for when you're building that particular plan. And we have seen, have we not, we've gone in, done these strategic reviews and found there have been absolutely no plans in some cases, haven't we, Amy?
Yeah, and I guess that's where we come in, isn't it, really, yeah. To help try and create that plan, which obviously would normally come at the end of a feasibility study or a strategic sure. review, wouldn't it? So you've got that evidence in place from which to build that plan and make sure it's deliverable and you know, achievable.
So that's right. The preliminary piece to the plan is that scoping exercise that comes from a good feasibility study where you've engaged all sorts of stakeholders around a draft case or vision for the project or the development vision. And similarly, for a strategic review, it's looking, when you're looking under the bonnet at all the nuts and bolts, and you refresh against changing circumstances. And we've seen that in various organisations as well, haven't we, Chris?
Yes, and understanding what actually works for your organisation, what works less well, what is more time and resource efficient. What are you spending a lot of time on for not a lot of financial return? Those are the things that go into a strategic review or an audit. And then what comes out the other end is a plan that actually says, this is what we do well, let's concentrate on doing these things.
Yeah.
And then once we've done those things, we'll do these things. And some may be concurrent or some may flow. But until you've got all that down in a coherent plan, you're never going to get anywhere.
So pick up the strategic review or the feasibility study report, distill out of that the what's been agreed by your governors or trustees, and write up your plan, your action plan, campaign plan, development plan. And it is a document that is designed to be used for all sorts of purposes, isn't it, Amy? How would
Absolutely.
We be using it?
So obviously it keeps the internal team on track. We all know what we're supposed to deliver and when and who's doing what. But it's really important for recruiting external volunteers as well to leadership boards and fundraising boards, and also for donors. You know, it's a way of showing them you mean business, you know what you're doing, you've got a clear route to get to goal, and that their gift is part of that journey.
It's funny too, isn't it, how many donors who, particularly if they're experienced donors, have given to various charities, actually like talking about the fundraising method and process and how you're going to raise the target. And they get a lot more confidence, don't they, as a result of having a look at your plan and maybe even commenting on it. Yeah, it's a good point.
It also should contain things like the donor charter and how are you going to treat your donors as well, right? So a level of that kind of gift policy,
assurances,
management. And they know that, you know, you're operating ethically and their gift's going to be managed properly, and, you know, they don't risk any reputational damage of investing in a campaign that's then not going to go to plan and might, you know, have some bad news surrounding it.
I mean, it's not rocket science to assume that the people who you are approaching for major gifts are intelligent, successful people.
No, it's almost a given.
It's almost a given, okay? And if they're intelligent, successful people who, particularly those who've made money through their own wisdom, business skills, etc., they're going to be the ones who are going to say, where's the plan? You've said it before. How are you going to reach that target?
Yeah.
That's a lot of money. How are you going to get there? Well, we've got a plan.
Yeah.
Here is our plan.
It's a good start.
It's properly thought through. It recognises our strengths and recognises our weaknesses. It's going to concentrate on our strengths. That's our plan. And these are the key performance indicators, the KPIs that we think will, between now and 2 years' time, will get us to where we want to be. And then your wealthy prospect, who is engaged as a donor may also think, actually, I could want to be part of this because I get it. I'm not into it.
And they're confident you'll be. Nothing is better. Success breeds success is the old adage. But there's a crucial element here because you're actually also bringing together the workings of a professional team, paid people, even that might be the leader of the organization, as well as your fundraising team. But also you've got influential volunteers serving as ambassadors and committee members, trustees. They all need to come together around one plan and understand how they're each going to play their respective roles. I often think of the analogy of the football coach and the football team. And you see the little boys and girls when they go out to play for the first time, they all chase, all 11 of them, after the ball on each side, don't they? But then they get coached and they suddenly find themselves one in the goal and they're in positions passing the ball between each other. The plan enables that coordination to happen. But Amy, one of the key things too is kind of who owns this plan? What's your views on that?
Obviously, it's signed off by whoever that organisation or campaign leader is.
Right.
But everybody owns that plan.
Right.
Everybody involved in the fundraising and the operation of what it's going to deliver needs to own that plan.
But you don't want this signed off by the director of development or something, because that sends the wrong signal, doesn't it?
We want that signed off by either the chief exec or the chairman of the campaign or whoever that is who's driving the fundraising and putting their name behind it.
Yeah.
Well, if everybody has bought into the plan, agreed it, and it's signed off by either an individual or on behalf of a group of individuals who lead the organisation, they're ipso facto is the organisation's plan.
Exactly.
And everybody, as Amy says, fundraising is a team game at the end of the day. Everybody has bought into the plan of this is how we're going to deliver this successful fundraising campaign.
Mm,
And if people fail to deliver their particular piece of it or suddenly turn and go, I never said I'd agree to that. Well, actually, you signed up to a plan and it was made very clear what the role was going to be.
Yeah.
Now, so the role may have been as simple as you're a volunteer, we only expect you to get one gift.
Let's cover off on that. What is in the generic headings, if you like, for a development campaign's plan? What sort of elements would you expect to see in there, guys? Amy?
So we start with the vision, don't we? What is it we're trying to achieve and why? And that's at the start of the plan. So
people it's the case. It's the case for support.
Case for support. Yeah. What is it that we're doing?
Yeah.
And then we get into more of the kind of the methodology, how are we going to go about doing it?
Mm-hmm.
What are our targets?
And our strengths and weaknesses. So what are we good at? What are we, you know, do we have an enormous prospect pool that we think are all going to give to this? Or actually are we going to have to be focused on 50 or 60 people who we think will give more to it?
Yeah.
And then allocate our time. So that's it. Methodology. Absolutely right. Do events have a part to play in this campaign?
And if so, where?
When?
Exactly. And then that comes to the timetabling, doesn't it? So when do each phases of these different fundraising, and we know that we would always start with major gifts in a capital project to achieve that 80-20, you know, the largest gifts first. When do they all fit in a time
frame? When's the campaign launch going to be? It's not going to happen at the beginning. It's the greatest misnomer, I think, in capital campaigning is to call the launch is normally the signal that we're in the final phase of the fundraising.
Yeah.
Years ago, I ran a campaign for a client who had previously run a campaign where they kicked off with a telephone element of it, which had been quite successful.
And quite typical then.
And very typical. So this would have been, 20 plus years ago.
Mm.
And so the guy who ran the organisation sort of thought, well, we'll start with it. And I said, no. If I'm doing it, we're going to start with the private phase, the quiet phase. Let's try and get some big money in. Let's identify which grant makers will be right for us to apply to. And most
at this stage,
when we will be applying to them, because that's part of your plan.
Yeah.
Some you can apply to at the start. Some won't consider an application until you've raised 3/4 of the money.
Mm-hmm.
Some don't need planning permission. Some do need planning permission. That's all got to be in your plan so that you know, come this month, we're going to do that. And that's a stage one application followed 3 months later.
Mm.
You know. But most importantly then, we were able to turn around and go, yes, there is going to be a telephone campaign, but it's going to come on the back of success, by which time we will have developed our lower level giving opportunities.
Just to maximise your impact.
And you can maximise your impact. Your campaign plan is almost like a sort of jigsaw plan, isn't it, really? Mm.
So having that laid out in the various phases means everybody, even the team member on one of the most distant regional fundraising teams, knows exactly what role they're playing, but also when's the right moment to appear on stage, so to speak. You know, it's all set out and how it's coordinated.
And roles and responsibilities. You know, if you're recruiting a campaign board or a development board for a school, and you make it absolutely clear at the start that you are both giving and getting, then people can make a considered decision to join that board on that basis. It's there in black and white. By agreeing to come on the campaign board, they have agreed to give and to get. Not just to come on and go, well, I think that's a really bad idea. Well, I think that's a really good idea. Why don't we do this?
To be the resident critic.
I think that's probably one of its most important values is that recruitment. And being able to use it to say, you know, there's some phenomenal people involved in charities throughout the UK and globally, but, you know, who give their time, their energy and their money. But there are a lot who like to sit on boards and actually don't do that much.
No.
So having those roles and responsibilities is a great way to say, listen, we really value you, but for this campaign, this is what we need people to commit to.
And it
can give people a polite way to go,
exactly,
and not lose that relationship and
or it can reflect.
That's a good point.
We've worked for clients that have a more public face, and therefore they may have some governors or trustees who are there because it's by virtue of their public life or their public role. You have others who are there because they have a personal interaction and they want to contribute.
Of course,
and I think it's when you've got a written campaign plan, you can set all that out and recognise that every organisation is slightly different. So we talk a lot in our world about the importance of leadership giving, and it is really important, but equally we have to understand and recognise that in some institutions somebody holds a position of leadership authority because they're the Lord Mayor or they're you know, whatever, and quite rightly they've never been told they've got to give and they don't have the resources to give. But your campaign plan can reflect that, and it comes back into recruitment. We need, the plan shows, we need a development board or a campaign board to drive our fundraising. The campaign board is not governing the institution.
No, that's a really good point. And you can separate and distinguish.
You put it in there, and then the governors are relaxed and happy and therefore like to be more supportive and collectively might get together and make the commitment. We all know how important that is, the collective commitment of the board. Whereas the individuals who've come on to help with the fundraising know that's what they're doing, and they know there's the plan, and they know therefore they've got a mandate to go out and do what they want to do.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I had a lovely one talking about leadership recently where interviewing a trustee for study, and we were talking about the scale of giving, and he declared his gift and said, I will help you get all the other trustees to sign up.
Oh, perfect. It's just music.
Gold dust, isn't it?
Yeah.
I said, I don't care if someone gives a pound. You need to give.
That's the point. Yeah, it's often when I've run campaigns back in the day, and again, it's part of the plan. You know, part of the plan is reporting. You will get a monthly report. Now, that's a great mechanism to be able to say, without naming anybody, X number of the Board of Governors have committed. So you don't even have to say that Y number haven't, because Y number will work it out for
themselves. but that's a very good point about reporting, because if you've got an agreed plan signed by the chairman or the chief executive, and it's got the KPIs and the timetable listed, it's got the job descriptions, it's got all the sort of measurables for performance that you'd expect, every month then you can report against that plan. And you can, it can really quickly focus trustees' minds, the board's minds, on what's going well and what maybe isn't going so well. The other plus is plans are not fixed in stone. I mean, you can move and develop that. And we, how many times have we seen the project itself actually force the plan to change because, you know, there hasn't been necessary permissions granted or costs have changed and we've had to revisit. But the plans can be updated and you could move forward with it, can't you?
Well, things could, listen, I started a campaign in November 2019. And so we set out the plan. It was all written by February 2020. The plan was written. By March 2020, everything had shut down. The plan had to be rewritten to reflect what was going on. Grant makers who we had identified and started having conversations with suddenly turned around and said, actually, we're pausing all of our grants in your sector for a year because we're going to focus on COVID relief. That's fine, perfectly understandable, but the plan had to be amended. And the same, you know, we all like to think, and in our cases, would like to think that the research work and the feasibility work we've done has given us a pretty good steer on what's going to happen.
Sure.
But sometimes it doesn't happen according to
plan. Yeah, but throwing a curveball, don't we?
Yeah, and things, the world moves on, surprisingly. Well, it turns, doesn't it?
You might have had a major donor lined up who gets knocked over by a bus.
Yeah.
Well, it was like yeah. another capital project that, that I worked on, whose project cost almost doubled and their first round planning fell through. So they had to reassess, reshape, we had to pause things. There were funders who wanted 50% in place, which previously we were reaching that threshold, but then we weren't because the costs had gone so high. And it was about reshaping and moving forward. And thankfully, they are nearly there now, which is fantastic.
But the plan helps you keep navigating that journey. And it can equally be, and I had one situation where a major donor came in actually very early in the campaign, paid for nearly three quarters of the campaign target. And we had to sit down and say, right, now we're going to reset the vision and the case. It was a wonderful place to be. And it really charged on from there. But that was, you know, you could have just, you know, tried to mop up the last little bit and the client would have missed out on a lot of money and the project wouldn't have been anywhere near as much fun. But actually, too, even the teams themselves in a plan, because they're volunteers, you'll have certain teams stepping up and doing certain amounts of engagement, information events and so on, and then stepping back and another group will step up. So even though you'll have in the plan an organizational chart, so everyone understands who they're relating with and how they're reporting up the line, because ultimately the legal responsibility sits with the trustees and the governors. So your campaign board's got to report back in either through the chief exec or directly to that governing body. But every one of the teams also has got to understand how they relate together. And as they do their bit and step back, you might want to create new teams as well.
And they change, like you say, don't they?
Yeah.
So a hospital charity we did some work with, we did the study and then they went on to run their campaign. The lady who was spearheading their regional fundraising did such a phenomenal job that I think she exceeded targets by like four times what they targeted to raise. So that shifted things there as well.
Yeah.
And then how they managed those people and the new donors that they got on board because she did so well. So it is a really evolving document, isn't it, that we and need to use as a guide but not be afraid to change.
Well, I think that's you know, everything that you, because fundraising is not an exact science, everything that you write down about fundraising has to be dynamic enough. And it can amend, it can be flexed. So expensive. I say, you've got a scale of giving. Your top gift on your scale of giving might be £250,000. The next five gifts might be the other £250,000. Somebody might give you £500,000. Then you're rewriting your scale of giving. Now, are you just taking away the top three tiers? Or actually saying, well, if somebody's given
us, are you increasing the target?
Are you increasing the target?
I've done that before.
Are you reducing the number of donors?
Yeah.
But if you've got an agreed plan,
and
you've got it down in writing, as Amy says, it's a guide, it's not definitive.
But you've got a way of approaching that challenge, haven't you? Instead of just going, you know, wet finger in the air, let's guess and write some interesting fantasy. You've actually, because you've got a plan that's in play, you can navigate through those changes far more effectively.
Absolutely. And there's another key factor here for those people listening who are leaders rather than the professional fundraising people. Having a written plan enables you, the leadership, to slightly hold your fundraisers to account, not so much in terms of the amount of money that is raised, but in terms of their activity.
Yeah.
If the campaign plan says that in month one, these things will be achieved, and unless there's very good reason, and sometimes there are very good reasons, but if unless there is very good reason, as a board of volunteers, as a group of volunteer leadership, you can turn around to your staff with every justification and say, you bought into this plan. Why hasn't this happened?
It's feed to the fire
and
time.
You can monitor actually how good your professional team is. That would include us as consultants.
Oh, for
sure. We contribute to plans.
Yeah.
If it's our responsibility to make sure that the 10 things we would happen in the
We talk about them as deliverables, don't we?
Deliverables.
It can also help give some more surety to, you know, the FD or the Bursa or whoever as well, because the campaign plan and all the activity in it feeds into a potential cash flow forecast. Now, as fundraisers, we hate cash flow forecasts because fundraising is so up and down, and you have months where, you know, you raise loads of money and months where you don't. But, you know if these applications are in by this date and you're predicting you're taking a 50% success rate, you can start to forecast when money might arrive. You know you've got a big information event in July.
Yeah.
It's going to take you 2 months to do all the follow-up.
Close out the arse.
Let's set a target for that.
Yeah.
So, you know, it can help with that wider organisational knowledge and getting behind the fundraising campaign as well, and supporting colleagues within the team in their jobs in forecasting and whatnot.
And that also works funders, with external third party funders, the larger ones. Very often they will ask, have you got a fundraising plan?
They do.
If you get part of your National Lottery Heritage Fund application, very often these days,
it requires a plan.
Where's the plan? And we, Andrew, we gifted, have in the past been brought in after a round one pass.
I know.
To deliver the to write the fundraising plan before you get permission to start. NIHF have said, I want to see the fundraising plan.
Yeah.
What's your fundraising strategy
for
the partnership funding? How are you going to raise it?
Yeah.
And if that's in plan, then you get permission to start. So it's really important that you get this down in writing, in an agreed manner. Everybody buys into it. This is what it's going to be.
Chris, there are plans and there are plans. I mean, I've reflected previously with you, I think, that part of my hobby job is being a local councillor, and we have a local council housing, and the officers came along and presented a 50-year plan for council housing. Now, I appreciate it's a lot of money. It's £1 billion of council housing, and it is a long-term, ongoing service that's being delivered, very important service. But 50 years, I mean, I could barely grapple, you know, with the next few years. And actually, if you think about it, you know, if you thought 5 years ago, did you plan to be where you are today? I'm going to bet I didn't. You know, it's developed in a direction, but it's not been, I didn't sit down and say, right, I'm going to be doing.
You didn't think you'd be sat doing a podcast no. 5 years ago,
I don't actually think I did. But my point, though, is I think for a plan really to cut through and be effective, you can use, by all means, say, look at a 3-year horizon, but focus sharply on detail in year one and then forecast out. And then, so you're developing the plan. You don't suddenly stop and have a fresh, you know, but these 50-year or 10-year plan, I mean, please, it's a set of values or, aspirations.
People go, we're on a 5-year fundraising strategy. Well, you can have a 5-year plan.
Yeah.
But the reality is years 2 to 5. But going to be fairly
but how much has changed?
You've got to do year one first. You get year one right, you're not going to.
Well, how much has changed even since the beginning of this year in the world?
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, you know. We often just do 6 months in advance, don't we?
Yeah.
I know I've done that recently with a client. We're doing this preparation phase, and in month 4 of that 6-month phase, we're going to write the plan for the next phase in detail. But there's no point doing that until we know how we're going.
But then,
it's really
useful. Then people will have it sitting on their desk, not gathering dust on the shelf, you know, because they're actually navigating every day's work.
And they've also
with their plan.
Into it on the basis they've seen what has happened. So there's your 4 to 6 month plan. Actually, everything's been delivered. Now, what are we going to deliver next?
Yeah.
And they've got the confidence that comes from knowing we've done the first 4 to 6 months.
Yeah, but that's
now we can plan the next.
But then isn't a brilliant excuse for a celebration? I mean, I love parties, as you know, but then you can get the team together and say, well done, we've done the preparation phase. This is what we said we wanted to achieve 6 months ago. Here we are, tick, well done you, well done that. Celebrate, because you're then preparing for the next and you can launch the next stage of your plan.
That's why it's so important the KPIs aren't just about the money. Of course, it's a fundraising campaign. Of course, ultimately, you want to raise the target. But we've also got to accept, and we've seen this a lot, where you can start the private phase of a campaign with a big flurry of income, because mostly you're going to the people that you probably spoke to during the feasibility study, and they've had additional time
to reflect.
So you've done them and you've got that first £250,000 in, but actually you wanted to have £750,000 in, but within 9 months. Well, it's the next £500,000 that becomes the difficult bit, because that's when you're starting afresh.
Yeah.
I've never forgotten with one of our early clients at Gifted, and we were speaking at a big national conference, and the campaign director, lady from the school, was there, and she said, God, I just wish we'd done more feasibility study interviews, because all our feasibility study interviewees were the first people to come in and give us money.
No,
and that's why we often say, don't we, to potential clients, look at feasibility, not just being about the art of whether you can or cannot doing it, but actually it's the first phase of your cultivation process.
And if you don't do it, your plan is meaningless. It's absolutely an academic exercise. It's not going to be fit for purpose. Completely.
Yeah.
But Amy, the other bit, I've seen this, you sort of get to the end again, you know, the moment you've achieved targets, you've achieved some, you maybe haven't got others, at the end of the plan cycle, it's really, really important in my experience to take the time to regroup and reflect to get that wisdom captured, because people change and you go back, don't we? It's often sometimes as consultants, we know more about our client's back history than the client leadership does because they're all new. Yeah. Is that fair? I'm not being unreasonable, am I?
Yeah, well, it provides, you know, it's like study reports, isn't it? It provides kind of what happened in that moment in time and what you did to deliver that goal. But then I think there's also learnings from it, isn't there? So it's things like, okay, the campaign's ended, but how do we now steward all these donors who've come on board because of all our hard work?
Exactly.
And supported the campaign. What's our next steps with those? And that kind of forms your then more of your annual plan, doesn't it, for how you kind of move forward with your sponsor.
And how are you dealing with the recognition that has been promised? Yeah. Are the name, who's managing putting the naming rights on this and that, or, you know, responding on the anniversary of that pledge to remind them how important their gift
again,
is.
Again, an example, I won't name any names, but I was at a client's recently and I was being shown around and I went into one building which had been funded through philanthropy and the donor board was covered up by boxes.
Really?
And to be fair to the fundraising person within the institution, they were sort of, I keep asking them to remove those boxes so that people come and they can see their names. But the staff who operated that particular building were just blind to, or deaf, probably more than blind, to the fact that, you know, and it's like, well, you wanted this building to do this.
Yeah.
People gave money willingly to do it, and all they wanted was just to have a little name on a wall. And you can't see it because you've got boxes in front of it.
So doing a bit of a review of the plan, when who's going to be responsible for looking after that recognition and keeping the stewardship? Because we all know, givers give again. The most likely source of your future philanthropic support are the people that have already given to you.
It helps reflect on what worked and what didn't as well, right?
It does.
So, I mean, how often do we see clients say, well, local corporates, they're going to fund this campaign. We know they're not going to fund this campaign. And sometimes you do get a great take-up, but other times you can reflect and say, actually, they're not interested really in what we do. Therefore, we shouldn't be investing time in that going forwards.
Yeah.
And we've proved that.
But we all, as individuals, we all give to things. Mm. You know, I can think of a gift that I made as part of being part of a campaign, and it was a pledge gift. My payments, my donations went out quarterly. I don't think I ever got thanked personally.
I've had that. Not one thank you.
Not with it. And actually, are they
not invited to the opening?
Yeah, I've not
Nothing.
Been. I've not been invited to have a look at it yet.
That's appalling.
And I noticed on my bank statement that even though I'd had an email to say, this is your last payment due, 3 months later, another payment went out. And then I contacted them. They went, oh, we're sorry. They couldn't tell us how we could stop the donor. It's like, well, can you cancel it now, please?
Mm.
You know, now, had I been back to see this...
I know, and you'd been asked.
I probably would have left that donation in place.
Yeah. Exactly. It's again, so the review bit of your plan, the lessons learned, the pluses, the minuses, and then who's doing the ongoing stewardship and how is that all, is a really key part of building out your future success in fundraising. So it's not just let's all drop in a heap at the end of this and...
Wasn't that fun?
And just hide the file.
Is it going to be an email that's generated by a database system, or is it going to be a personal approach? Well, you know, and I think everybody's different, and you've got to do what you can afford to do.
Mm.
But within the plan, you've got to have something that's realistic and you know is going to be effective.
Yeah, Chris. Any final thoughts then, as we wrap up on campaign plans?
You know, do your homework and make sure it's realistic and effective. There's no point in going, oh, you know, we're going to raise £10 million by having 10 bulls, because that isn't going to happen.
Yeah, very true.
We're going to raise £10 million by raising £2 million here and £2 million there and £2 million
there. But the clear plan gives you that focus.
The plan gives you that focus.
Yeah, helpful. Amy, yours?
Just say make that plan, but don't be afraid to be agile and change that when you need to and things shift.
It's
got to be workable at every moment in time.
It's a living plan. It's not set in aspic. No, absolutely right. Well, thank you both. I'll let you scoot for the motorways of Britain as you head back to Leeds and London. But really good to get together again today for Gifted Talks Fundraising. Thank you, Chris.
No problem.
Thanks,
Cheers.
Amy. Thanks for pulling up a chair and joining our conversation today. Please share any comments or even post some questions for future episodes by emailing us at inquiries@giftedphilanthropy.com.